From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And today, President-elect Donald Trump meets with more prospective hires, including ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson, as he expands his search for Secretary of State. Later tonight, Trump holds his second thank you rally for supporters in North Carolina. We've heard from many people who are concerned about how the Trump transition is going. Right now, let's bring in Arizona Congressman Matt Salmon, who supports Trump. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be on the program.
And what do you make so far of the Trump cabinet picks? Some are looking at them and saying, well, they're very conservative. Others are saying they're too close to Wall Street, some of them. And in the case of Ben Carson, perhaps too inexperienced in the area that he will be in.
I think they're making some pretty amazing picks. And from what I understand, it's the quickest that any administration has moved in putting forth cabinet officials probably in the last 40 years. So, you know, I think I'm very, very impressed with Tom Price as the head of HHS. He's an amazing person. He's one of the most thoughtful people on healthcare that I've ever met in my life. So I think he'd do a great job. Nikki Haley, Secretary to the UN. I think there's some amazing picks. General Mattis for defense. I think it's moving pretty well.
Any of the picks that you don't like?
I haven't found anybody that I don't have respect for. I was hoping he would find a place for Ben Carson. I had the opportunity to meet privately with Ben Carson and his wife, spent about an hour with him several months ago before he got into the presidential race. And I just think he's an amazing individual.
Who would you like him to pick for Secretary of State?
Well, I think there's some really terrific options out there. Different people bring different strengths. I think Mitt Romney is an incredible individual who has vast talents. You know, I think he'd be a very good pick. I'm also very, very favorable to John Bolton. I think he was an amazing secretary to the UN. I think he's kind of a no-holds-barred kind of guy. But I think that any number of the people, John Huntsman, who I've heard of late, people are saying he's not really in the running. But John and I have been friends for a long time. And, you know, as a former ambassador to both Singapore and China, and also working on the trade desk for Asia, for a time. I mean, there's probably not a more thoughtful guy than him. So that's why I'm saying it's hard for me to say which one of those would be the best. They all have different kinds of strengths.
You chaired the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific. What did you think of President-elect Trump's phone call with the Taiwanese president and his tweets about China?
You know, ultimately, the Obama administration has been talking about a rebalance to Asia for a long, long, long time. Meanwhile, a lot of problems have arisen in the region. China has been very belligerent in the South China Sea and the East China Sea with Japan, in building military installations on islands that don't belong to them, violating international norms and standards. They haven't lifted a finger to help us with North Korea, and I think everybody who understands the situation knows that they hold a disproportionate influence with North Korea over anybody, and they haven't really lifted a finger to do anything.
But are there risks in all of those areas to doing what Trump just did?
Look, I think that China has a lot more to lose in a divide between the United States and China than the United States does. They enjoy more than a $300 billion trade surplus. Also, Taiwan is the single largest investor in China. So I don't think that they're going to do something that's going to really upset the apple cart. I think some of what Trump is trying to do is send a message that our bilateral relationship is going to be on equal footing. And I think that's a breath of fresh air.
And what do you think about what some of your colleagues have a problem with, Trump talking about tariffs on companies that move jobs out of this country and try to sell the products back to the United States? People are seeing that as unconservative.
I think he's trying to be real provocative and, you know, fixing some of the serious problems that we've had in losing American businesses that are going overseas. My hope, my personal hope, is that his focus would be more on tax relief. We have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, 39%. And I think that focusing on tax reform and on regulatory reform would probably be the best course of action to keep American businesses on our shores.
One more issue I want to ask you about, and that's immigration. Do you expect Trump to actually build a wall all the way across the southern border? Do you expect him to deport all of the 11 million or so undocumented immigrants in this country? Or do you think he's starting to soften on that?
You know, I think that what he'll find is some of the same things that I found when I got elected, and I talked to our Border Patrol agents and our ICE agents, that so much of the problem that we have today in illegal immigration is them not being allowed to do their job. A lot of them complained to me when I met with them, and we're just not allowed to take off the shackles and get it done. So I think that he's going to look at those kinds of options. Building a wall would be incredibly expensive. And, you know, what's the solution on the other side to a 8 or a 10 foot wall is a 8 or 10, you know, or a 9 or an 11 foot ladder. So I think that he'll find that there are solutions readily available without having to build a massive wall. On the deportation, my personal belief is that after we secure our borders, after we get that taken care of, I think that we need a pretty substantial guest worker program. And in fact, I think that if we had a program that basically said, if you want to stay here and work, we welcome you. But if you want to get on public assistance, we need you to go back to your own country. I think you'll find a lot of support.
Do you think you'll find support in the White House with President-elect Trump?
I think so. I think Trump is a very pragmatic individual that's going to be looking for solutions that actually work.
Why did you decide to retire? Your last day is basically going to be this Thursday. You're joining us now from the ante room to a conference room because you don't have your office anymore. But why have you decided to retire?
Yeah, I tweeted out a picture of me sitting in a chair next to a Pepsi machine, and I said, this is my new office. I'm away from my family about 80% of the time. I don't regret having served my country, but I miss the time that I've been able to be with my family.
Do you have any advice for your fellow Republicans who are staying in Washington?
Yeah, my advice is don't be hypocritical at all. The things that you've railed on Obama for, basically wiping away by this administration of the whole separation of powers doctrine. And if the new president-elect, does the same kinds of things, even if they're things that we like, if he does things that are unconstitutional, that we stand up and fight for the Constitution. I think that our founders clearly intended for this to be a divided government separated by three co-equal branches, not one more equal branch than another. And I hope we get back to that.
That's retiring Congressman Matt Salmon, a Republican who represents Arizona's 5th District. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In Oakland, California, fire crews have resumed their search, sifting through the rubble of Friday's deadly warehouse fire. Oakland Fire Battalion Chief Robert Lipp said today that the death toll remains at 36, but crews haven't finished looking.
There's one corner that remains unstable, and then that's another thing that we're going to be doing throughout the day today is stabilizing that corner so that we can search that last section.
And last night, about 1,000 people held a vigil at Lake Merritt in Oakland to mourn those who died. Sam Harnett from Here and Now, contributor at KQED, was at the community gathering space in the heart of the city and has this report.
The mourners have brought electric candles and glow sticks. They surround the pavilion.
So tonight, let us lift our candles, our lights up high in honor of those individuals whom we lost in the ghost ship fire.
Friends and family take turns at the microphone, paying tribute to the dead.
Hi, my name is Roxy, and I'm here for Edmund Lapine. I actually just got word from his mom that they just identified his body.
Many here knew someone who died in the ghost ship fire.
So 5 people I've known for the last few years died in this fire.
Jason Kick is a musician. He came from Indiana in search of a community that embraces diversity and creativity.
Well, my biggest fear is a witch hunt as far as all the other warehouse spaces that exist, and I do think that there is an onus of responsibility on the people who run these venues.
While mourners gather here, the Ghost Ship Warehouse lies in ruins 2.5 miles to the south. Catherine Wethington worries her friend is one of the bodies yet to be discovered.
I don't have her number anymore, and she doesn't have a Facebook account, and I know she may well have been there because she used to live there. I don't know what to do.
Thank you, Russell and Nihar, and everyone that's ever taught us something about DJing, and just got to keep dancing. I love you guys. Thank you so much.
Down in front of the pavilion, a group holds up giant white sails made out of gauze and cardboard, like the sails of a ghost ship. They bob up and down, and in the background, the ring of lights around Lake Merritt are like tiny flames, flickering on the water's rippling surface.
This is a busy time for high school seniors preparing for college. The deadline for a lot of schools' regular admission is January 1st. So for more on what students and their families should be thinking about this month, we're joined by Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, my old school. Lisa, welcome back.
Hello, Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for coming back. And I wanted to start with one thing that may happen in December, which is college interviews. The question being, should students interview and how much do these interviews matter?
Sure. I always tell students if you're invited and unless you have extreme anxiety to communicate in person or you've got travel time and expenses because you're invited to maybe interview outside of your local area, you really should take them up on this offer. Nowadays, Jeremy, most interviews are done by local alumni who try to make it easy and, you know, invite you to a coffee shop or their office. It's about bringing the paper person to life. So if you have that ability to take advantage of those and they're extended to you, oh my gosh, I tell students all the time, go show your interest. You'll learn about the school in a deeper, more personal level. And in the end, they're going to gain valuable information that if they do end up getting accepted to that school and have to make that hard May 1 decision, they've got a local contact that they can also reach out to and ask additional questions as well.
And does it matter if you do a bad job in the interview? Are you done at that school?
Yeah, I'm asked that often. And actually, I tell students, keep in mind, these interviewers do not work in the admissions office. The alumni interviewers are volunteers. They're loyal to their institution and want to help. So I tell students, don't look at them as an obstacle to getting in. Don't add that interview as an extra worry on your shoulders. Relax. It's a conversation. And frankly, I know people who actually volunteer for their alma maters, and they've interviewed students and made incredible pleas to say how great they are. And sometimes those kids don't get admitted. So their part is to truly relax the student and to be a resource for them.
What about the cost of college? A lot of families thinking about that right now. Should they already be talking to financial aid offices if they need that kind of assistance?
Sure. One thing I want to always do is empower families to not be scared to call financial aid. You're not bothering anyone. That's their job. And actually, many families may have started early conversations with financial aid even as a junior because those net price calculators are available. So if you've done that and you filed your FAFSA and your CSS profile and you feel like, again, those very limited portals don't give your true picture of what your financial life looks like, when you're accepted, or even now, start those conversations and let them know that you have maybe changes in circumstances. If income has changed, you definitely want to talk to them. And families often say, well, when should I know if I should contact financial aid? Basically, anytime you have a question, don't hesitate, but be patient with them. Be courteous with them. Learn to put everything in writing if you have something to actually say, and make sure that you're always courteous and patient with them. You're not going to get answers right away, but they are there to help you.
And what do you tell students about if they're applying early to a college and they don't get in, or they do get in? What are they supposed to do with that information?
It's important for students to know, have a thick skin. Because the reality is this process now that they went through with the November 1 or November 15th deadline will bring them an outcome before winter break. And Jeremy, what breaks my heart is the kid who potentially doesn't get in before winter break or even gets deferred to the next round. And they are so deflated that for them to then get through January 1 deadlines, to pick up that spirit and say, wait a minute, I'm not going to let that bring me down. I'm going to actually do the best I can for January. It's important for them to know those early outcomes can either bring about an acceptance, a denial, or a deferral. So they just have to know that if they went into that process in November and did their best effort, they just have to process it, talk with their counselor, talk with their family, And if they are not accepted or deferred, they have to get through those regular decision applications with a very positive spirit.
It's a lot to take all at once for these students and their families. I mean, I'm getting stressed out just thinking about it.
And honestly, Jeremy, that's the hardest part. December is crazy. I mean, mental health and balance in the month of December is a huge concern. Kids are stressed. Parents are extremely worried. Are the kids even doing what they're supposed to do? As oftentimes, the seniors don't even want their parents talking to them, because any question from a parent that says, "Are you working on your application?" literally makes the kids go into a spiral. So one of the things that I like to tell students is there are three things that challenge you in the month of December. Obviously, how you process early outcomes, how you plan your communication, and how you make a plan to get your college apps done. I don't want a student to go into the month of December thinking that their holiday break is completely ruined, that they're stuck on a computer even up to New Year's Eve, because that's not necessary, Jeremy. If they think about how they want to map out the month of December, still have time for friendship and family and fun, and when they hit that submit button that they trust that they've done their best work, they can really have a balanced time. But I do want families and parents to understand their job is to trust their student, but also reframe the questions. Don't ask your senior, "Are you working on things?" That instantly shuts them down. Start off that conversation to say, "Hey, I know you're responsible. I know you've got a lot on your plate. Can I help you in any way? I'm here for you if you need me."
That's Lisa Maselli, the Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana. Lisa, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And you can read through more of Lisa's tips for students and families at our website, hereandnow.org. During his two terms in office, President Obama has used his powers under the Antiquities Act of 1906 to designate more than 20 national monuments, more than any other president. Now, a coalition of American Indian tribes are hoping the president will take action on at least one more tract of land in the Southwest. Laurel Morales of Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
Some of the geological formations in the Southwest look like something out of a Dr. Seuss book, and Bears Ears is one of those places. It's a dramatic pair of buttes, or steep hills, that emerge from the ground in southern Utah. They're covered on one side by a ponderosa pine forest, and the other by scrubby pinyon juniper trees.
It's a very sacred place. Leave it the way it is.
Navajo elder Jonah Yellowman holds the branch of a juniper tree as if he's shaking hands with it.
We talk to these trees. When the breeze comes through, they talk to us. Sometimes when you're out there, when you're by yourself, you can feel something over here. You can hear something. Sometimes you look over there.
At the end of a windy, unmarked trail, Yellowman picks up a piece of Anasazi pottery laying on the ground.
Oh, wow.
So as you walk around, you find something everywhere.
Bears Ears is rich with such artifacts. There are more than 100,000 archaeological sites. Leaders from five tribes have asked President Obama to protect these lands from looting, mining, and off-trail vehicles. And they'd like Obama to set aside 1.9 million acres as a monument. Jim Enote is a farmer and director of a Zuni Museum and Heritage Center. He says Bears Ears contains a library of knowledge.
Bears Ears helps us to connect the dots of our history and our ancestors' experiences. And those places, those homes or those shrines and altars, when they were built, they were consecrated. And once they were consecrated for life.
On one of his visits to Bears Ears, Enoch came across an old village where he made offerings, much like people would at a cemetery with flowers. Then he noticed someone had carved into the petroglyphs and dug into a dwelling wall.
How could anybody do something like that? We wouldn't do that at a cemetery. Of course not. If people are able to respect places like cemeteries or war memorials or war battlefields, places that are sacred to many people, why can't they afford us the same kind of respect and civility?
It is a sacred place. It's sacred to all of us.
Angela Hurst grew up in Blanding in Utah's San Juan County, picnicking at Bears Ears almost every weekend. She can see Bears Ears from her backyard in Blanding.
That's it, right there.
Oh, wow.
We see it every day. It's part of our home. Mm-hmm.
Hurst and many of her neighbors don't want a national monument. They worry their farming and ranching land will be taken away.
I'm afraid that making a monument takes it away from us, makes it so much less accessible to the regular people.
Under the tribe's monument proposal, people would still be able to picnic, collect firewood, hunt, and graze their animals with permits. But San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman is weary of federal overreach and opposes giving Bears Ears a monument designation. Lyman says he and other local leaders should be the ones to manage it, not the federal government.
I've never tried to exceed my defined authority, and I wish the federal government could say the same thing, because they are constantly pushing the bounds of their jurisdiction, their authority, their legal reach.
As far as the future of monuments go, some Republicans would like to do away with the Antiquities Act and put more control in the hands of states. Sarah Krakoff, a law professor at the University of Colorado, says Congress does have the power to change the law.
And there have been murmurings in the past about wanting to amend the Antiquities Act after President Clinton designated some big monuments in the West. They never get very far, but with two houses of Congress in one party's hands, Republican hands, and President Trump, you know, as president, I suppose it's more likely than it has been in the past.
Meanwhile, Utah Republican congressional leaders have filed legislation with fewer protections for the land and more local control. They say putting Bears Ears on the map as a monument would draw the same problems tribal leaders are trying to prevent. A monument designation may attract more looters. For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Morales.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
If you've been to Nashville, Tennessee, you might remember a quirky carousel along the banks of the Cumberland River. It was designed by the pop artist Red Grooms to honor famous Tennesseans. It had delighted both tourists and locals since the late 1990s, but then it was abruptly taken down. Chaz Sisk, with Here and Now contributor WPLN, found out what happened to the Red Grooms carousel and how it might come back.
As we stand together in a warehouse, the Tennessee State Museum's Bob White hits me with a quiz.
You recognize any of the other characters?
Grantland Rice.
That's correct.
Grantland Rice, the famed sports writer, is one of 36 famous Tennesseans who graced the Red Grooms carousel. Rice is wearing a fedora and pounding away at a typewriter. With a body that's part baseball player, part horse, carousel riders would have sat in the saddle. There's also Olympian Wilma Rudolph, her torso fused with a tiger, a reminder of her time on the Tennessee State track team. Ryman Auditorium builder and riverboat magnate Tom Ryman merges with a steamboat. Country City Kitty Wells and a tour bus.
Let's see. What's the turbaned guy over here?
Sequoia.
Oh, that's Sequoia, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course.
The inventor of the Cherokee alphabet. He's holding a pipe and giving me a mischievous sidelong glance. If all goes well, the Red Grooms carousel could whirl again next to a new state museum building now under construction. All it takes is money, says museum spokeswoman Mary Skinner.
That would be a win-win for everybody, but we're still trying to raise the money for the actual new museum.
When the carousel opened in 1998, as many as 10,000 people a month were paying $1.50 each to give it a ride. But over the years, that number fell to about 2,000. Since 2004, the dismantled carousel has been sitting in pieces in estate warehouses. Two separate agencies asked me not to say where, such as their fear it could be targeted by thieves. Museum officials refuse to say how much the carousel is worth, but it's likely in the millions. Grooms, who now lives in New York, is regarded as one of the greatest artists to ever come out of Tennessee. Here's how Elizabeth Hodermarski, a curator at the Yale University Art Gallery, described his work to Connecticut Public Television.
Warm. You know, there's so much of contemporary art that's very cold and metallic, and red is really all about humanity and warmth.
The Tennessee State Museum occasionally brings out pieces of the carousel for exhibitions, but the agreement all along was that the Groom's Carousel would be entirely reconstructed when the museum moved into its new home. But as planning has dragged on, the carousel has lost its priority status. It's no longer included in the project's $160 million budget. Deputy Commissioner John Hull says the state will need at least a few million dollars to rebuild the carousel and place it in its own enclosure.
It's a historical piece. It's an art. And so we think that in order to maintain it over the long term, it actually has to be inside a structure and not exposed to the elements.
It's so clever and so beautiful, and it needs to be up and running and visible.
Attorney Bob Took was part of the organization that ran the Red Grooms Carousel when it was in downtown Nashville. He keeps a model of it in his office. It's one of the few ways to see today what it looks like when put together. Took recalls schoolchildren riding the carousel to learn state history. He can't think of a better place to put it than the State Museum.
They are not living up to their promise, and that disappoints me. If they go ahead and do it anyway with another fundraiser, I'm all about that.
Tennessee officials hope to complete their study on rebuilding the Red Grooms Carousel early next year. For Here and Now, I'm Chaz Sisk in Nashville.
Democrats are still trying to figure out how to win back white working-class voters after last month's loss to Donald Trump. And at least one member of President Obama's cabinet has a few ideas. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack is the former governor of Iowa, and long before the election, he'd been warning his fellow Democrats that the party needed to reach out to rural America. I spoke with Secretary Vilsack yesterday, and I asked him if he saw the Trump victory coming.
I wouldn't say that I saw it coming, but I had some concerns about how accurate the polls were based on my travels throughout rural America for the last several years. And it's not just this campaign. I think this has been a situation that has been developing over a period of many years, and I think it finally came to a head in this election.
Yeah, and it wasn't until after the election that it seemed that Democrats collectively started scratching their heads, wondering what went wrong. But here is President Obama a couple of days after November 8th, where he suggested the Democrats lost in part because they didn't run an effective ground game. And he used your home state of Iowa as his example.
I won Iowa not because the demographics dictated that I would win Iowa. It was because I spent 87 days going to every small town and fair and fish fry and VFW hall. And there were some counties where I might have lost, but maybe I lost by 20 points instead of 50 points.
You know, you're friends of the Clintons. You were in the running as a possible VP pick. At any point, did you advise Hillary Clinton that she might want to take a page from the president's playbook here?
Well, clearly, during the course of the primary, that was a message that we conveyed, I conveyed to the Clinton campaign. But honestly, this extends beyond. The president's right. He did, in fact, go to Iowa. He did, in fact, spend a lot of time in those small towns, and I think that made a big difference. There was one difference, though. When the president ran for the first time in 2008, mm-hmm. we had a Democratic governor, a Democratic legislature, and a Democratic voting registration edge. All of that has dissipated over the period of the last 6 or 7, 8 years. So now we had a Republican governor, a Republican House, and all of the Republicans in Iowa leadership positions were forcefully behind Donald Trump. Having said that, I think if you look at state legislative races, you look at congressional races, you look at Senate races, and now you look at the presidential race, the Democratic Party needs to spend some time, some resource, and some effort in rural areas, because the president is absolutely correct. You cannot afford to lose those places 90-10, 80-20, 75-25, which is has happened in far too many elections in the last couple of cycles.
So what happened? I mean, why did Democrats feel that they could afford to turn their backs on those voters?
Well, I think that there's an understandable desire to focus on the future and to focus on increasing and expanding populations in the country, and that's all well and good. I think the reality is you have to do both. I think you have to have a strategy that essentially speaks to the entirety of America, because we have a message that I believe will sell, And we have taken steps to provide help and assistance. We just haven't marketed as aggressively and as well as I think we should have.
And how do you suggest the Democrats do that? Because just last week, Nancy Pelosi was reelected as House Minority Leader. Of course, she's from California. Chuck Schumer from New York leads the Democrats in the Senate. And from that vantage point, I wonder if you think the party can convincingly sell its message.
Well, Senator Schumer is a very good example of someone who pays attention to rural areas in his work as a U.S. senator from the state of New York. I can't tell you how many phone calls I've fielded from Senator Schumer based on issues involving dairy operations and based on upstate New York. He pays attention, and the result is he wins 60-40, 65-35 in his reelect effort. And there are examples all across the board of Democrats who have done that. Michael Bennett, another individual who spends some time and pays attention to rural areas. Al Franken, another example in Minnesota. If you spend some time, if you educate, you can win, and you can begin the process of building back state legislative bodies, which I think are critically important. I mean, the Republicans have done a very good job of systematically picking off state legislative chambers to the point where they now can control reapportionment. They also create a bench for congressional candidates, for gubernatorial candidates, and Senate candidates.
I'm speaking with Tom Vilsack. He's the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. And let's shift gears just a little bit here. U.S. farmers exported $40 billion worth of food and agricultural goods to China and Mexico last year. Of course, those are two countries that have been clearly in the crosshairs of Donald Trump. What do you think the Trump administration would mean for the American agriculture industry if he gets into a trade war with China, if he drops out or renegotiates NAFTA, as he's promised to do?
Well, I think that I recently had a meeting with a number of ag commissioners and secretaries from states, mostly conservative states, and I pointed out that just that fact. Essentially, if you have and engage in a trade war involving China and Mexico, it will have adverse impacts on American agriculture. 30% of all farm sales are trade-related. 20% of all farm income is directly related to trade, and our number one and number three customers are China and Mexico. So in order for agriculture to continue to prosper, there has to be a much more nuanced conversation about trade and a much more nuanced conversation about China and Mexico than Mr. Trump has had up to this point.
Yeah, well, what's the nuance? Because trade, obviously, a huge motivating factor that got voters to the polls to support Donald Trump. I mean, were they just plain wrong about, you know, his stance on trade? Is that what you're saying?
An understanding to note the difference between globalization and concerns you may have about its impact, technology and its and automation and its impact on employment versus trade that can, in fact, create jobs. Every $1 billion of ag sales generates and supports about 6,500 jobs at home. Farmers understand the benefit of trade because they see it in the bottom line, in their income. There's a tremendous number of Americans that are employed as a result of trade who have not lost their jobs because of trade. They may have lost their jobs because of mechanization. They may have lost their jobs because of globalization and plants moving from one country to another, but that's not trade. And the nuance is being able to distinguish between globalization, mechanization, and trade. They are three separate and different components. And I think we have to do a better job of explaining the difference.
So again, Democrats perhaps missing the opportunity to message that. But, you know, Trump did promise to limit regulations, not only for farmers but for businesses. He promised to limit the EPA's reach into farming. He was in favor of corn ethanol subsidies, for limiting the tax rate on farms. You know, you might say his infrastructure plan could be a boon to rural voters. I mean, aren't these the types of populist messages that really might help the people who supported him?
Well, there's no question that regulations was an important area. But I think we need to put it in the context. If we had done a better job of explaining what his rhetoric might mean relative to agricultural trade, if we could have explained better the fact that an immigration reform bill really is about making sure we have adequate workforce on the farm and in processing facilities that will allow us to continue to be a food secure nation, we might have been able to balance off the I'm going to get rid of regulations message. Democrats, I think we need to be much more consistent and much more forceful in terms of explaining the benefits that the partnership between people and government has had and will continue to have.
You've got something like, I'm trying to do the math here, what, 40, 45 days left in office? I'm wondering if you're in just cleaning out the desk mode at this point, or is there something that you still feel like you can accomplish before January 20th?
Well, just today we were continuing to try to impress upon Congress the necessity of passing funding for opioids under the American Cures Act. We're also talking to folks in Congress about the necessity of fixing the fire budget. We have a horrific situation with our National Forest Service.
Fighting wildfires, you mean?
Fighting wildfires and being able to see more and more of that budget being eroded by fire suppression instead of maintenance. So we're continuing to work, and we'll continue to work right up until the very end.
Well, then January 20th, of course, President-elect Donald Trump becomes President Trump. We're all watching as his cabinet takes shape. As far as the Agriculture Department goes, some names have been floated around. Sam Brownback, Kansas governor. Sid Miller, a controversial commissioner of agriculture in Texas. But I want to know, from someone who's been at this job for 8 years, the entire tenure of President Obama, what do you believe will be the biggest flashpoint in your agency for the next ag secretary?
Well, I think they're obviously confront the fact that our commodity prices are not as strong as anybody would like them to be today because there's a substantial amount of surplus in world commodities and global markets. There's going to be a farm bill that will have to be reauthorized, and that's a tremendous opportunity for an administration to focus not just on the farm safety net, but on jobs, on infrastructure, on forestry, on conservation, research, and so forth. It'll be interesting to see how easy or how difficult the development of a new food, farm, and jobs bill will be.
U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The future of Uber is becoming a little clearer. Yesterday, the ride-hailing company, which is valued at about $69 billion, acquired the artificial intelligence startup Geometric Intelligence. It is a big bet on AI, one that is shared by Google, Facebook, and others. And it's just one of the ways the company is trying to evolve its business as it continues to outpace its competitors. Here with more is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Johanna Buya is senior editor at Recode covering transportation. She's in New York. Hi, Johanna.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. And tell us about this decision by Uber to make this bet on Geometric Intelligence. What is that?
So Geometric Intelligence is a 15-person research startup that focuses on artificial intelligence. The 15 people are all PhDs of some sort or professors at a number of different universities. And as part of the acquisition, Uber also announced that they're opening up an AI lab in the company that's going to be headed up by the Geometric Intelligence CEO, Gary Marcus. So like you said, it is a pretty big bet on AI.
And is that about driverless cars?
It's about driverless cars, but machine learning and artificial intelligence has the possibility to enable Uber to automate their existing platform much more than it is. It has the ability to make their routing algorithms more efficient. And with its current app, you know, the app is integrated with things like Google Calendar. You can sort of foresee a day where the address from your Google Calendar will just, you know, pop up into your app, and then maybe the app will hail a ride for you before you even realize you need it.
We're also seeing other companies make big investments in AI, including Amazon, which just yesterday announced it's going to open a grocery store called Amazon Go that uses AI to eliminate the need for a checkout line.
Yeah, I mean, AI is sort of the buzzword du jour of the tech industry right now, so much so that, you know, universities aren't even churning out enough talent to meet the demand. And that's because AI and machine learning are a fairly new field. So there is sort of a talent grab right now.
There are other changes going on for Uber. Over the weekend, you reported that Uber New York would no longer cut prices for its rides. This is something that stirred up a lot of angst among drivers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Independent Drivers Guild is a pseudo-union. It's not an actual union because Uber doesn't actually have to negotiate with them, but Uber has agreed to meet with them once a month to hear out drivers' concerns. So it's a very informal conversation, but we learned that Uber's New York general manager told the drivers that they shouldn't expect any more price cuts. That said, it's not clear whether the company will actually hold to that, whether they've even had, you know, formal conversations about that. So they usually do it every year in the post-holiday winter months. So, you know, in January and February, we'll be able to see if they're actually going to follow through on that.
What about Uber more broadly? We saw a report the other day that Uber is on track to lose $2 billion a year. There are big questions about whether those numbers are correct. But how is the company doing? Are they making money or are they losing money?
So the analysis itself, you know, there are, like you said, there are a lot of questions about it. That said, you know, reportedly in previous reports, Uber has been losing a little bit over $1.2 billion just in the first half of 2016. And that, I mean, Uber CEO Travis Kalanick has said before, when they were in China, they were losing $1 billion a year. So the company may be profitable in the U.S., but in order to retain market share, they have to do things like subsidize rides. So they've been losing a lot of money, but I think the idea is eventually they will gain enough market share where they won't have to do that anymore.
Well, explain that about subsidizing rides, because you would think they have the most obvious business model ever, which is some driver comes, picks you up, takes you to another place. They get paid a certain percentage of that, and Uber gets paid a certain percentage of that. Why do they have to subsidize?
Well, just because of the nature of the competition in China and India in particular, you know, there's very little rider loyalty to a service. Riders are basing their decisions on what, you know, which service to use based on pricing and convenience. And in order to basically lure drivers away from the competing service and riders away, they have to give riders discounts and have to give drivers incentives. And that's incredibly, incredibly expensive.
And what about Uber's competitor Lyft? What are the challenges there? Are they making or losing money, or are they making these investments in artificial intelligence?
I have to believe that they are. I mean, I don't think that they can compete without that. But they are also, you know, have a very difficult problem, because Lyft, you know, since the beginning of its service, has pitched itself as their friendlier service. But that's, you know, a very difficult thing to scale when the only interaction a passenger has with the service is via a driver. And drivers are independent contractors. Legally, Lyft can't train them. They can't tell them how to perform their job. So they can't make them be friendlier. So in order to solve that problem, they've started rolling out this device called AMP. It's, you know, fairly meager in its capabilities right now, but it's an LED and Bluetooth-enabled device that will, you know, glow one color to signal that that's your rider, but also has messages on the back to kind of, you know, be the friendly face of Lyft without forcing your driver to do it.
That's Johanna Buya, who is senior editor at Recode covering transportation. Johanna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.